This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. The investigation into the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City has drawn attention to the militia movement, a loosely knit web of right-wing paramilitary organizations that exist around the country. My guest, Chip Berlet, is a senior analyst at Political Research Associates, an institute that studies authoritarian, right-wing, and xenophobic political movements. For more than 20 years, Berlet has been tracking the rise of the extreme right, from the militia movement to white supremacist groups like the neo-Nazi Aryan Nation and the Ku Klux Klan. Although the militias vary, Berlet sees some underlying beliefs they all share.
The militia movement in general is built around a core theory that the government is about to impose some form of repressive martial law or take away our civil liberties, and that the first step in that is gun control. But behind that is a larger suspicion that secret elites control the government in some way. That's a belief structure, by the way, of the entire Patriot movement, which is a movement of as many as 5 million people in this country who listen to everyone from the neo-Nazi right on the far right to people like the Birch Society and Pat Robertson, who promulgate conspiracy theories about the Trilateralists and the Masons on the moderate wing. And everything in between is the Patriot movement, out of which comes the armed militias, which are the armed wing of the Patriot movement. And all of this is taking place in the background of a populist right-wing revolt that really is a backlash against the movements of the 1960s and is also linked to a declining economy in the heartland where a lot of people feel economically distressed.
As far as these militias go, do they have clearly defined objectives that you can pinpoint, or are they preparing in a more global sense for civil war?
Some of them are clearly preparing for civil war. Some of them would argue that they are preparing to be defensive, in defense of the Constitution and in defense of liberty against a tyrannic government. Some of them are aggressively proactive and believe that there will have to be a civil war provoked by them to restore liberties which they feel have already been lost. So there's a range of zealotry, there's a range of paranoia, there's a range of reasons why people join. The single unifying theme is that the big government is out to get you and that you have to arm yourself in defense of liberty. And they see themselves, remember, as the new patriots standing at the bridge in Concord. Unfortunately, they're belief in this conspiracy theory is irrational, and so they're acting on these beliefs as if they were real, but they're not.
I'd like to know exactly what goes on in a meeting of one of these militias.
Well, there's two forms. There's your basic lecture format, and there's your basic outdoor activity. The outdoor activity would consist of getting dressed up in camouflage clothing and training with live weapons, shooting at targets, learning how to get under barbed wire, learning how to establish a defensive perimeter around a building, and all that good stuff, including first aid training and intelligence training and communications training. And that takes place out in the woods someplace or in your community someplace. The basic, informative lecture format might start with a video by Mark of Michigan or Linda Thompson or William Cooper talking about the variety of the conspiracy that they're most interested in that day, something to do with the New World Order being imposed throughout the world by a sinister elite, and that's why the economy is so bad, and that's why things are going to hell in a handbasket. Then it would depend on what kind of militia you were in. In some militias, the most extreme, you would then learn about the Jewish bankers and that how blacks are taking over America. In the more moderate ones, you would learn about how the Trilateralist Commission and runs the world on behalf of the Rockefeller family. And then there would be variations. Some militias, you would learn about how it's God wants you to stop abortions. Some militias would talk to you about how the real terrorists are the environmentalists. You might find that we're in the biblical end times and the mark of the beast is coming as prophesied in Revelations. You might find that the Second Amendment is the cornerstone of the Constitution and therefore gun control is the single biggest issue in your life. The only through line would be the government is bad and about to take away your liberty and that the first step of that process is taking away your gun.
And this would all take place in some big Grange Hall or lecture hall?
The one I attended here in Massachusetts was in a high school auditorium. They could be in a Grange Hall. They could be in an auditorium that's rented for the occasion. It really depends on the size of the audience. And the audiences in some of these meetings are upwards of 700 to 1,000 people, although they tend to dwindle down as time goes on.
Are there people there hawking their books?
There are book displays. There are displays of dried food pallets that you can have delivered to your door by a truck with 6 months of food and water all palletized and dropped off on your front door. There are long theoretical articles on the secular humanism conspiracy theory and outcomes-based education as a brainwashing attempt against your children. There would be a display of some mechanical devices that don't require batteries because the electricity is going to be cut off, so you need hand-crank flashlights and hand-crank radios and things like that. There's a whole subculture. This is actually a very large subculture in our society that's virtually invisible to the average person.
There's a book circulating now among the more extremist groups that includes a description of a bombing of a federal building. It's called The Turner Diaries.
That's correct.
Is this the book each new recruit gets handed once they show up at a meeting?
No, it's the book that the most neo-Nazi, most zealous terrorist wing of the militia movement would take seriously as their Bible. I would say that the average militia member has more likely read Pat Robertson's book, New World Order, than the Turner Diaries or Hunter. And indeed, Hunter talks about the political assassination of Jews, politicians, and homosexuals, where the Turner Diaries talks about blowing up a federal building. But this would be like the manual for the armed terrorist underground of the militia movement. Most militia people read The New American from the John Birch Society or Pat Robertson's books, which, by the way, talk about the New World Order and the Illuminati and the Freemason conspiracy theories really quite out in the open. Some theories, in fact, cited back to sources that are overtly anti-Semitic. And so this is a much more popular discourse than people know. But that's the mainstream discourse in the militia movement, is this paranoid conspiracy theory about the Freemasons and the New World Order.
If you go to one of these meetings and you're in the big hall looking over everyone's literature, would you...
How would you get recruited into the terrorist underground?
Yeah, well, would you come upon the Turner Diaries or a manual on,
sure,
on how to build a bomb right next to a display of homeschooling?
Right. Well, yeah, the way it would work in terms of how you move from the moderate to the militant mode is you'd go to one of these meetings, you'd be standing at this bookstore display, and the bookstore would say, we have everything, we don't censor. So they would have everything from a homeschooling manual to a diatribe against abortion to a book like The Turner Diaries or Hunter, which I picked up at the militia meeting I went to, and they'd all be intermixed. And if you'd be sitting there looking at one of the more neo-Nazi books, for instance, somebody might sidle up to you and say, if you're really serious about that, you should come hear a lecture by so-and-so that we're going to have in my home next week. And if you went to that lecture and you nodded at all the right places, somebody might call you a week later and say that maybe you'd like to come to another meeting. And if you sort of passed all the tests of the right zealotry and the right background check, you might then get invited to be part of a 12-person cell that would divide up into communications and manufacture and delivery and counterintelligence and end up going out with a truck to buy fertilizer.
There was a book that circulated among left-wing groups called The Anarchist Cookbook, taught you how to make bombs. Is that still in print, and is it circulating now among these right-wing groups?
Well, in fact, The Anarchist Cookbook is alive and well and circulating through all of the militia movement, available at your local gun store. So, yes, that's still around. And there is an interesting overlap. There are some people who think of themselves as progressive and left-wing who are increasingly buying into these essentially fascistic theories of state repression, and that they're so offended by the federal government that they're willing to work with ultra-reactionary forces against this repressive regime. Well, I will point out to you that that was the operating theory of National Socialism in Germany.
My guest is Chip Berlay of Political Research Associates. He tracks right-wing groups. We'll be back in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Chip Berlay is my guest. I'd like you to describe for us how significant Waco and the Branch Davidian siege is to these groups and how they use it in their rhetoric.
Well, again, I get away from the extremist lunatic paradigm and say, you know, a social movement forms when there's a demand for it by a discontented population. So you had a movement waiting to happen, coming out of this backlash against all of the civil liberties and civil rights movements of the 60s and the environmental movement, because early on, many of the people who the militias first started to come up against in the far west were environmental activists. So you had this population ready for a movement to happen. Then you have these two galvanizing incidents, the Weaver family standoff and the Branch Davidian situation, which was both cases of government misconduct, clearly, where there were miscalculations and deaths resulted, many deaths in the case of the Waco incident. That was the galvanizing moment to bring together a number of diverse right-wing groups around the belief that the time had come to stop the repressive government. The issue they then mobilized around, because every social movement needs an issue to mobilize around to build that common unified goal, was to stop gun control because of the Brady Bill and the Crime Control Act. So you had the galvanizing moment pulled these people together. They organized a social movement to stop gun control, and then they made the first big transition of all social movements is that they got beyond their first issue and survived as an ongoing social movement.
So these groups, or the members of these groups, see themselves at a critical juncture as having more power, more resonance in society, more significance than ever before?
Yes, and at a critical moment when they are going to be the people who stop this descent into tyranny.
No group has specifically taken credit for this act, obviously. What significance do you read in this? And I'm thinking, if one of these groups is behind the Oklahoma bombing, do you see this anonymity as part of a strategy?
Sure. It is likely that the people who blew up this building, if it turns out to be tied to the right-wing terrorist underground, are people who engage in leaderless resistance. Comes out of the race hate movement, and it basically is this idea of individual cells taking responsibility for their own acts of violence to destabilize the government and bring down the government so that the true constitution can be restored. So it would be a tactic, I think, to not claim credit. It's the politics of destabilization.
Richard Snell was a white supremacist who was convicted of murdering a Jewish businessman and a black police officer. He was executed 12 hours after the explosion last Wednesday, and he said as his last words, "Look over your shoulder, justice is coming." Now, before his execution, many militias had been protesting his death sentence and calling for action in their literature. How does he fit into this story?
He fits in as a martyr, as a symbol of the patriot going to his death standing for liberty. And again, I'm not telling you what I think, I'm telling you what that they think. There's two other through lines. Obviously, one is that it was the second anniversary of Waco. Another one is that it was Patriots Day here in New England. Concord's just down the road from where I live. These people remember, self-perceive themselves as the new Minutemen, the new Patriots. Snell is a martyr to that cause for many of them, the most extreme wing, I have to admit, but the people most likely to take a terrorist act. And Waco was an incident that was seen as proving that the tyranny had arrived, that the government was run by traitors. And there also was the idea that the government had to be made to pay for what happened in Waco. And if you believe, if you're coming from Old Testament biblical law, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, blowing up an office building of federal workers and their children is just retribution for what the government did in Waco.
Well, I'm trying to place the bombing in Oklahoma in a context of escalating violence among these groups. And 6 months ago, civil liberties organizations began warning that the potential for violence among the militias was on the rise. What evidence did they have?
Well, I was one of those people. The evidence was their increasing rhetoric, the increasing number of people who seemed willing to believe that something apocalyptic was about to happen. There were several times on the internet and in the fax networks when there were these alerts that went out that the invasion was coming and people should flee their homes. So there was an increasing sense of militancy and resorting to violent rhetoric in the radio broadcasts and in the newsletters and newspapers and in public speeches. The militia movement continued to grow after the midterm elections, and you would have thought that if this was a social movement that was more electorally oriented, that the November elections would have undercut it. But it continued to grow because these people were so angry and so frustrated that they didn't even think the Gingrich Congress was right-wing enough to satisfy their demands. even though gun control played a major role in the election of many of these people. So I think it was only a matter of time. I know I'm not the only person who said this. I mean, there were people at the Coalition for Human Dignity, at the American Jewish Committee, at the Center for Democratic Renewal, at the Anti-Defamation League, our group, Political Research Associates. We were all running around. Even Planned Parenthood was people running around saying, don't you get it? This is going to explode. And I have to tell you, we in this community of researchers knew there was going to be some action that was going to take place on that day. We just had no idea it would be so horrific. I mean, some of us thought they might blow up a radio tower from a government radio tower, or they might do a pipe bomb in the back of some IRS office. Nobody imagined it would be something like this. We thought it worse that they would assassinate some government agents.
So what steps did you recommend
months ago and all along? That people take this seriously, and of course, to the most part, people thought that we were crazy. Hand-wringers. I mean, I got to tell you, I've tried to pitch this story to the media for about a year now, and for the most part, with few exceptions, there was not any real sense that this was a dangerous movement. It was, for the most part, covered as something that was very comical.
I was thinking that the denial that we saw in the first 24 hours of the bombing, the denial that this might be something that involved homegrown terrorism, that has been functioning for years and is part of the resistance to warnings from analysts like yourself.
Sure.
Has it also prevented the government from developing good surveillance of these groups?
Well, you got to be cautious here. I mean, I am a card-carrying member of the ACLU and the National Lawyers Guild as a paralegal investigator. The problem is this. The vast majority of people in the militia movement are engaged in activities that are entirely legal and protected by the First Amendment, and that you could put agents all throughout the militia movement, and it is unlikely that they would penetrate the terrorist cells that carry out the criminal activity. And I can tell you this with some certainty, because I was a paralegal who read literally 100,000 pages of FBI and other government files of infiltration of groups like the Civil Rights Movement and the anti-war movement. And in fact, sending infiltrators and doing surveillance of these movements was almost pointless in terms of trying to track militant underground groups like the Weather Underground. That's not how you find these people. That's not how you stop these people. So we have to be very careful not to trade our civil liberties for some meaningless quick fix that erodes our rights around the terrorism bill, a terrible bill. Allowing the FBI to conduct massive surveillance, it's a bad idea, and it isn't effective.
So what does work?
Well, there's two things that work. One is to just accept the fact that terrorism has to be protected against, but also that terrorist groups come out of a social milieu and that you have to address the underlying social problems to stop the terrorism. There's always going to be a handful of people who engage in irrational terrorist acts, but terrorism is carried out by people who have a political commitment to an idea that is current in the society. They are merely the most zealous messengers of that idea.
Do you think the end of the Cold War has fed the anger of these right-wing groups, that not having a foreign communist enemy to unite against has turned them towards their own country?
Well, you've hit on something, but I want you to split it into two issues. The end of the Cold War changed the scapegoat from global communism to the federal government and creeping whatever tyranny. But social movements are based on a real self-interest anxiety. The globalization of the economy has, in fact, created a situation where people who bought into the social contract, who were many of them are veterans, many of them worked for many years, they feel like the social contract has been ripped up and thrown in their face. They did everything they were supposed to do, and now they're getting screwed. So that anger is what then mobilizes them, and it's then the scapegoat that they choose to pick that is determined by the end of the Cold War. You can't blame it on creeping communism destroying the moral fiber of America anymore. You have to blame it on the federal government, and let's invert what's really going on here. The government is to blame because it's allowing all of these people, like blacks, women, immigrants, welfare mothers, to become parasites on the society and to force us to be politically correct, so to speak, which we don't want to do. So really what it is that although there are women and black people and Jews in this movement, they're very, very a small portion of it. This is, in fact, primarily straight white Christian men reacting to their loss of privilege and status in a society that is being globalized economically and cutting off their career paths, and that is changing rapidly in terms of social conventions around sexism and racism and homophobia.
How far back, then, can you trace the origins of the Patriot movement?
Well, in a sense, all the way back to the Salem witch hunts and the scapegoating of women who were non-traditional, and back to the anti-Masonic conspiracy theory. What you have to look at is that throughout this movement, there are states' rights arguments that were the code words for the segregationist movement. Some of these constitutional arguments go back and were the idea that the state didn't have to obey federal laws that it didn't agree with that led to the Civil War. So that even though that's not why many people join this movement, that really is embedded in the movement. And also some of these conspiracy theories go back to the protocols of the Elders of Zion, anti-Semitic forgery, go back to the Jewish banking conspiracy theories. And again, even people who might join the militias thinking seriously that they have nothing to do with racism and anti-Semitism are really being woven into a movement where these are echoes that are very distinct. And so people have to be aware that even if someone says, I would never be a racist or anti-Semite, but I'm in the militia, that embedded in the militia movement are some of these historic racist and anti-Semitic themes.
Thank you very much for taking the time to talk on Fresh Air today.
You bet. Thanks.
Chip Berlay is a senior analyst at Political Research Associates in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.